Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, makers, artists, podcasters, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. How are you discovering and solving the grand challenges of our time? This is a driving question that fuels David S. Kidder's work as a founder, investor, speaker, and author. From the books New to Big, The Intellectual Devotional, and The Startup Playbook, to the company he co-founded in 2013 called Bionic, everything he does is co-created with other people. In this interview episode of Getting Work to Work, David shares about what goes into discovering the future, how to ignite growth revolutions, why the special forces model works for his team, how forgiveness of failure is essential in learning and taking risks, and why he only focuses on things he deeply cares about. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/317. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources blowing my mind as well. David, welcome to Getting Work to Work. What's one thing people should know about you?
I'm a father of three sons, aged 9, 12, and 13. I would just say I'm a very good lion cub trainer. I enjoy the job.
What's one of the enjoyable things that you've trained your sons to do as a lion cub trainer?
Well, it doesn't always work, but I train them from young ages to use the word, what can I do to earn it? So earn it is a big lens they look at the world through. So I'm proud of that.
Was that something that you experienced in your upbringing to earn things, or is it something that you've just been exposed to throughout your career and your research?
For me, growing up, it was a necessity. Nothing was coming to me unless I figured that one central problem. So very young, hustling, and from paper routes to local stores to lifeguarding to college, you know, just my first startup at age, 20. That was the North Star, was how to figure out how to do the work to trade value, time, and money for an outcome. So my teaching my boys have a different path, but same intent.
That's cool. What kind of things have you seen that just blows your mind as they work through what that means for them?
My most recent favorite story is my youngest son, Lucas. We were at a World Series of lacrosse qualifier in Long Island about maybe 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And someone had dropped off a pallet of like power bars for free. And so he went and found his own table and set it up in front of this pallet of probably 500 of these free bars. And he sold them all day. And since he had no, for free, since he had no cash register, he used one of the boxes as a tip jar. And he made about $140, which is incredible. But the best part of the story is that he negotiated a deal to have someone work with him to co-found this. And he loves Shark Tank. And the kid didn't work as hard. And so he was furious in his indignity that he had to keep his deal and split the spoils of this hard work with him. And he wanted to renegotiate, which I didn't let him do. But anyways, those are moments where I'm like, okay, I think they're starting to get it.
Oh, what a great story.
Yeah.
So one of the recurring themes in your work is the future. And how in the world do you discover and build the future?
The future lives in the intersection of really three things. One is outside forces. They could be technology, they could be government, they could be environmental, but they're usually things that are extraordinary in their scale and their misunderstanding. And those create new problems and needs in the world, new portfolios of problems or needs that behavior is shifting to. So if I'm very good at understanding the outside forces, the implications of the problems or needs, and I have a way to watch behavior shift into the solutions of the problems or needs, I can get pretty good at understanding where the future is taking us. But those are very specific skills in both the way you think and the way you see the world that allow you to discover that future.
Wow. How have you trained yourself to really think that way?
Success is a bad educator. So, you know, going through absolute brokenness will definitely reshape your mind. So part of being an entrepreneur is not everything works. Being right and on time is a huge part of success. But in general, it's just really in hard learned lessons, but also just really deep curiosity. And so one of the books I wrote was called The Startup Playbook, which was 40 interviews with some of the best entrepreneurs in the world. Elon Musk, Sarah Blakely of Spanx fame, Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, who wrote the foreword, and really ask them, how do they bet their life? Like, what are the lenses you view the world through that allow you to select those right ideas, those right solutions to those new problems that have led to, in many cases, multiple billion-dollar outcomes? All the entrepreneurs effectively said an idea passes through these five lenses over typically a 24 to 36-month period before we know that it's going to be effectively huge. And those five lenses are central to the way we view the world here at Bionic and how I make all of my angel investments. I've done about 40 in the last 15 years. It's really our philosophy.
I'm fascinated too, as you go through a process of interviewing people, being someone who loves interviewing others as well, when you do the first few, you're almost in a different place than when you get towards the middle and end of the project. And how did the Startup Playbook evolve as you go from the idea to really living in the reality of, wow, I'm interviewing all these people and this is what they're saying?
I think you always receive what you give. If you care more about them and their journey and that the question, I think you get really profound insights. And so obsession around why, right, goes beyond just the advice. It's really about why, like what's underneath it all. There's the outcomes of their life, and then underneath the outcomes are the decisions and choices that they make, the way they think. But underneath those choices is really why. Why do they make those choices, these outcomes? And I think you can kind of get tactical. I think people are very transactional and getting short-circuiting, you know, their advice corpus to get to those answers. But that's sort of only half the answer. I think what's underneath it all is that why. And I think you really need to know that to lead to truth. And I think you have to be very, very curious about that question to get to really profound insights.
Was it uncomfortable to learn to ask why? I mean, you mentioned curiosity, but knowing about curiosity and really embracing it and being comfortable with asking why is a whole nother ballgame.
I mentioned the outside force. It's really the inside force. For some entrepreneurs you meet, you realize that they have gone through really hard life experiences of loss or shame, and they're trying to cover it. They're killing themselves to feel better about themselves. And some are really because they had a life-changing event. Their parent died, or their sibling, or they went through a crushing experience. And because of that, they're like, this should never happen again, or I can solve this. And so what they have is that first lens is that they have a proprietary gift. They have a secret. They know something that is impossible to know, because if you didn't live through it, if you didn't care more, you wouldn't be able to solve it. And that's why little companies are such a big threat to big companies, because the unfair advantage is that those entrepreneurs know something, have a secret and a power that the large organizations have lost.
Whew, that's powerful.
Yes, it is. I just be very candid. We at Bionic work with, you know, a half a dozen or more large organizations at a leadership level to do the work that we do, which is to disrupt them in our model called the Growth OS, which is in this book, New to Big. But what I wrote the purpose of Bionic 6 years ago, which was to ignite growth revolutions. That's why we exist.
Yeah.
I used to think about it as a money and a startup thing. This is what they needed. But in reality, what has been true is that the desire, the purpose of igniting growth revolutions is really about the interior life of the leader. They are this limiting factor and or the unbounded factor of why growth exists in the organizations, because it's limited or unlimited in themselves. And those are inescapable truths about entrepreneurship or leadership in the decisions that you make that shape the outcomes.
So how long have you been at Bionic?
I started Bionic about 6 years ago, and my co-founder, I, Anne Berkowitz, have been scaling this up. We have an incredible team, and we are bootstrapping, and we just built a big, beautiful new space in New York here. We have the genetics of the company just bring together venture capitalists and entrepreneurs and transformation specialists to go do the work that we do in sort of refounding the companies from the top down. They're going through massive disruption, not only from the outside, but just in how winning organizations are built. And our belief is that venture capital and entrepreneurship are literally forms of management of doing the new to big. Growth is 0 to 100 million revenue, which is completely opposite in many cases of the job of efficiency and optimization and scale, which is the big to bigger. Two different jobs, but every CEO needs to be able to do both. You have to be able to operate and create going forward.
I'm curious too, when you're an organization that focuses on disruption, what does a typical day in the life of Bionic that's described as a collective of radical outsiders, great phrase, by the way, what does that look like?
Well, my day is now at this stage in our growth. I spend a lot of time sharing our story. I do a lot of speaking. I do all of our growth with my two heads of growth, both marketing and BD with me, John C. and Christina, who it is important to over-communicate. Christina Wallace, my co-author of New to Big, who's brilliant, you know, is the primary author, the pen in this story. And she is a 1+1=10 person in my life and really brought all the cohesion and the organization to the work we do so that it can be read in 2 hours and 200 pages. I kind of make it more complex than it needs to be. They always say the hardest thing in the world to do is make something simple and takes the most intellect, and she's great at that. We have a whole organization that drives all the pieces. We run the company in a special forces way, not a hierarchy. It's actually a network. So lots of fantastic leaders with lots of responsibility and ownership building us.
Is that kind of like a holacracy model, or is it just something different?
No, it's a very good distinction. One of our advisors on our board advisors is Jenel McChrystal, Stan McChrystal, and he has a book called Team of Teams.
Okay.
And he was the first four-star general to run, in this case, the Allied forces in Afghanistan and in Iraq during the second Gulf War. And he developed this model, which is a distribution leadership model, where you kind of go from a general to a gardener. And it's a very different model, but it allows the revolutions of learnings to grow by two orders of magnitude in terms of speed and velocity. We run Bionic as if it was special forces as opposed to a hierarchical organization to compete faster, learn faster, but also to hire people who don't necessarily need a boss, right? They're there for a mission and they need you know, guidance, but ultimately they're there because they want to lead themselves so they can lead others.
On the website, you talk a lot about fast eats big. And I'm curious, when you're hiring people, when you're working with people, how can people increase their speed and yet maintain quality?
You know, the only way to go faster is to do less work, as I say. So the question is, what gears do we rip out that make us go slow? And what do we replace them with that is faster and good enough that we can believe in? And so part of, you know, Eric Ries's movement in the lean movement, which was predominantly for startups, we call it validating because there's a lot of disciplines around this that an enterprise needs vis-a-vis a startup. But in principle, the whole experimentation, build, measure, learn model is the same. And it's effectively science, right? Hypothesis, assumptions, tests, etc. So whether I spend $1 million or 50,000, and ideally it's a very small number, I actually am getting to truth. Truth is in the behavior of the customer. It's not what they say, it's what they do. And so if I'm a CEO and, you know, every time I ask a question, it costs me $1 million to get the answer in 6 months, that's not fast enough. You're not, the learning velocity of the organization is at an asymmetrical disadvantage to what is happening outside and the commercial truths outside the walls of the building. So I need to build a new system that has the ability to get good enough answers that are fast enough to shape the decisions that create my future. And that's what we do.
One of the ways I'm imagining you're able to do that is through one of the core values, 7-to-1, which, as you write, gives us permission to move fast, take risks, then learn and grow. So can you explain a little bit about what 7-1 means and how you make sure it doesn't become 1-to-7?
It's actually rooted in a bunch of relationship laws, ratios that you have to do 7 times as much good as you do bad. I think the science is actually 5, but I chose number 7 for a variety of reasons. But the reason is that we symbolically try to do extraordinarily more good than we do bad in a ratio that is basically impossible. And you need impossibly good people who want to do impossibly powerfully good things to make a company successful because the odds are against you. But more importantly is that we recognize the one, the ratio in that there is that we're going to fail each other. Things are going to break. We are imperfect human beings. We need to have forgiveness of failure in a culture to learn and to take risks and to grow. So I think, you know, the fastest way to kill a relationship or a marriage or, you know, a company is contempt. It's the indictment of you'll always be this way or your failure is you. And I think this helps us as a culture recognize both as the CEO and as each other to have, you know, undeserved forgiveness as central to the company's belief so that people can be themselves, take the risks. And so when we fail, we shoulder to shoulder can look at the failure as opposed to the individual holding their pet failure saying, I am a failure and this is going to cost me something. We have to have a way relationally to move through it. And so to see it together and solve it, there may be deep work to do. You may have a character issue, maybe have an experience or a skill issue. Great, fine, let's work on that. But let's deal and stare down the truth in a way that is healing, learning, and allows the permission to grow.
How does that change the people that work with you and how they work through failure?
Well, one is you assume it's going to happen. In fact, it's actually hugely beneficial to fail cheaply. We call it productive failure. That's not a new idea, but it is the idea that it's teaching you something of what not to do. So great entrepreneurs and I think great organizations use experiments and productive failure to get out of the dark alleys to find the ones with light. And so you don't want to spend a lot of time trying to make something true that's not commercially true. That's how we light our money on fire. And so great entrepreneurs run a lot of experiments so they can be taught the truth, find the growth, and then scale into it. And I think this is one of the things I think large organizations have to ask themselves is, does my company tell me the truth? Do my people, these good people, is my organization set up to give me the commercial truth? If the answer to that is no, my otherwise good, talented people are lying to me. The reason why is because the cost of failure is too high. Culturally, economically, incentives, I can't get the truth because people are trying to make things that are not true. And as a result of that, we are failing and we're lighting our money on fire and doing it. So we got to find a model that gets us to that new truth.
That's fascinating because this is the second or third time you've really mentioned the importance of truth in business and I think in life in general. And how we really approach truth is an indication of our leadership.
Yeah, it's on display. It's you can't hide it. There's also the omission of truth too, like implicitly, explicitly. So by not going after the things that we know are not commercially true, we actually are endorsing the lack of truth. We are creating the environment and the skills and the tools, the how to bring it forward. And eventually the company becomes a biased direct reflection of whatever the leadership believes. There's no more learning. It's just, we are trying to reinforce biases towards our view of the world, our view of the value of our product, our competitiveness, our position. And ultimately, you're blind to the change. You're blind to the truth from the outside in because the market is the ultimate boss. The market is the ultimate purveyor of truth and not in concert with it. You have a very serious cultural problem that starts at the top.
You work with giant companies and organizations. A very, very much smaller organization. And yet what you just said rings true whether you have thousands of people or one person.
Yep. We are, you know, we're a little under 60 people. So, you know, we're in our kind of ugly teenage years of building our company and working through that stuff and, you know, growing a lot. And so we have to eat our own dog food. We speak these things and, you know, we create a culture which is transparent enough for people to challenge it openly. I don't think you can build any company without people who are willing to be challenged and challenge each other to elicit the evidence that makes great decision-making in truth.
So you've mentioned New to Big. What was really the thinking behind writing that book in terms of were you seeing challenges? Were you seeing a certain pattern going on in the working world where you needed to speak to a certain audience about this book?
Yeah, I mean, our business for 5 years was referral, and it is largely referral. Our biggest partners, we work with P&G and General Mills and Nike, Citi in the past and others. And so they're large organizations. they know each other. It's a small world, as it turns out. But it also takes a long time to like drive the learning of the kernel of our offering. And I remember one of the things I learned from my last company. I had an investor named Peter Thiel from the Founders Fund, and he talks about how competition is for losers. It's a joke, but he's quite serious about it, which is, you know, if you have a company that's so profoundly positioned, why would you ever either give away your secrets, but also why would you have any competitors? Why would you try to? And so we didn't write the book to create competitors. We wrote the book to accelerate the movement around the ideas of our business that help us grow faster, because we kind of know how stupidly hard to do this work is by now. And so after 5 years, we feel uncatchable to some extent. And we're kind of on version 5.0 of this. And this is sort of like giving away beta. And so it was helpful in growing us and growing a brand and the value in the world and hopefully educating new and future customers.
So what's kind of a short synopsis of New to Big in terms of the concept?
So New to Big describes the model of growth. And the growth model that we are drawing from is the idea that venture capital and entrepreneurship are literally forms of management. To create growth, you need both an incredible investor and an incredible entrepreneur who have a mindset and an operating rhythm that works from the outside in the outside forces that shape our future, in an experimentation model that brings a new truth. And this is really important to understand, because this model allows one profound insight to be realized, and it's this. About 80% of all your returns, 70-80%, come through 7-8% of all your investments that you make. So if I make 100 bets, 6 or 7 will be the 20 to 50x that pay for everything else, because everything else is going to fail or just return my capital. And so the question is like, well, how do we make the 7 to 8 decisions? If you're a manager in a big company, you're like, well, let's just get good at that. And the answer is you can't. And the reason why you can't is because the failure of the others teaches you the 5 or 6. And secondly, is when you go back to the beginning, you said, why do we make those investments? They have two qualities. One is high conviction, meaning we discovered a proprietary gift to win a new space. And number two is non-consensus voting, which means you make all of your money from the ideas that have the highest disagreement rate, because it's the most misunderstood. It's the most new to the world and new to you, which means you have to seek instinctually friction. Conversely, if you pursue consensus, you're basically screwed. You can't win because it's not new to the world. It's understood. Yeah. And so your instincts have to completely change to create growth, because it's about learning and unlearning. And so that's what that job is. That's not optimization big to bigger, administration by degree. This is about discovery, not planning. It's about new markets and needs, not existing. It's the total addressable problems of the world that are emerging, not the total addressable markets. You have to go after that in a fundamentally different way. And that's what Bionic does. And that's what the New to Big book tells, is how.
One of the things that I really appreciate as a creative entrepreneur, I didn't really understand before I read the book that I have basically two modes of operation. One is creating new ideas and businesses, and the second would be operating those that exist. I would often just focus on one or the other to the detriment of the one that I'm not focused on. And so it really speaks to this idea of balance between, I think, new to big and big to bigger, and how they operate together.
They absolutely work in concert with each other. They are both vital skills. You have to do both. In the past, you may be able to acquire and create efficiency, but after that efficiency is gone, you know, you're basically left with your ability to grow the business. And you have to make great decisions in where to grow the business. You don't have that choice anymore. Also, if you're going to do an M&A strategy or create that growth, the reality is that most companies today that you're acquiring to even produce those outcomes, i.e. through acquisition, are already coming to efficiency. So the missing piece in all of the Fortune 500 today is a permanent capability to create growth. That is that $0 to $100 million revenue, that zygote to ugly teenage years of growing something up that's quote unquote little, you know, why do I care about that? Turns out those ideas are not little. They're worth 10 times as much in revenue. It's not 50 million in revenue, tiny little thing. It's worth 500 to me. So if I can get it to 50 or 100, I can scale to the moon. But they're equally difficult jobs, and they must be equally valued.
One of the chapters that really just blew my mind was the growth leader challenge chapter and the importance of having a growth leader mindset. I mean, mind-blowing stuff. Can you share briefly what the growth leader mindset is?
Well, it starts in a lot of reflection. You have to ask yourself, if the company is a direct reflection of my mindset and biases, what is it blind to? I think that that's something only a CEO can answer. And, you know, I mentioned before the statistics around non-consensus and unlearning. I think that the CEO, again, or the leadership team starts to reflect on, have I created the how to be able to do discovery? I have an operating system for planning. Do I actually have a way to discover the behavior shift that my customers are on in the journey for solutions to problems? Some problems I know today, but there are emerging needs in the world and problems that they're shifting to. And so if I have a mountain of customers, you know, tens of millions of customers or hundreds, it doesn't matter, and my mountain is dying and I fundamentally don't know why, despite my best planning and the best research and the best consultants in the world, I still can't get ahead of its death, right? It's because I'm literally blind in my ability to discover why. Where is the behavior going? Where is the need going? What biases are we holding on to that are no longer true? And so it's not just the learning, it's our ability to unlearn. You can't sort of be held in two truths like trapeze bars, ripping your arms out, right? Sometimes you need to have enough strength in your commercial truth to let one go so that you can actually create the momentum to swing away into the future. You can't hold both. So how do you know when to let go? And that's that learning skill that I think these CEOs are trying to do, is create a mechanism, a permanent capability to answer where that behavior is going, that's discovery and planning that creates that future that they can manage. And it lives and dies in their permission for themselves and the organization to lead them there.
And I think what you're speaking to is really one of the points that you make in the chapter, is the need to expire data. I mean, that was mind-blowing in a lot of ways, because it made me just question, what are the things that I've been holding on to for years that are no longer true, which then triggers the whole learn-unlearn cycle?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are hard to let go, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of biases around how we organize our time, our energy, our money, you know, how we sort of treat ourselves that are, we think are improving our lives or improving our performance, that are actually not based in any fact. It's just some sort of drifted, you know, accumulation of biases. And so I think unlearning is a really important measurement of things you're putting down that the organization should account for, as opposed to just feel.
Any secrets to getting through sometimes the emotional or psychological nature of unlearning things?
Well, certainly that control in many instances is a myth. So the, I think central to this is the belief that between my balance sheet and my money and my brand, I am driving the marketplace, right? The inside versus outside forces, like what is really driving that? So giving up the perception that you control the future is a big part of unlearning. I actually don't control my customers. If I don't control the outside forces, and I'm at the mercy of them, that kind of changes what you believe about what your job is, right? Your job is to ride the waves, be pulled out into opportunity, as to create your own pool of it. Make sense?
Yeah.
That's a different mindset about how you create value in the world when you don't have a dominant controlling mindset. You're participating in growing in abundance through solutions, new problems, as opposed to zero-sum capturing and monopolizing it.
The image that popped into my mind as you were describing this was surfing. And you're either riding the wave or being thrown under the ocean by the wave.
If you want to go really deep into stuff, I've had now three startups, two work, one didn't, which is you actually accelerate your failure when you are actually trying to control the outcome. It actually limits the option set because you're making your idea work, or you're so dominated by fear that you no longer can accept outsiders, other forces, paths to success. There's only yours. And so as a result of this, you actually limit the option set that's available to you because you can't even consider it. But more importantly, the option sets that are available to you won't consider you, right? And the reason why they're considering is because you're not available to be influenced. You're not available to be conspired with. You're not available to be partnered with to discover it. So part of letting go, the idea of control, means you accept several things. One is, I'm completely open to whatever the answer is and wherever it comes from. And number two is, I am neither a success or a failure. In fact, you kind of have to accept both outcomes. Like covers of Time magazine, I'm a hero or I'm an idiot. Both could happen and both are very unlikely to be true, right? So when you give up the control, you accept all the outcomes, failure, success, you're actually free to make the decisions, to allow influences, partnerships, collaborations, things that you don't control to actually drive your success as opposed to make it about you and control and accelerate your failure.
Fantastic. I mean, there's so much freedom in what you just said. I feel like I can just take a big breath.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very hard earned learning. I got to tell you, I wouldn't be able to say that unless it was something I went through. And I had great people around me to help me walk through those moments where you have to give it over. Mm-hmm. Then you can rest. Now you're not in control. You can actually get sleep and you can think and you can be clear and you can consider all the options. And I think that's a very special place that leadership really thrives.
What are some of the surprises that you've gotten from writing New to Big?
Well, I co-everything. So I co-author, co-create, co-found everything. So I want to make sure that I over-communicate the leadership role Christina did in writing this. I'm really surprised just how deeply this has resonated with people. You know, I look at a lot of the books I've written or, you know, co-authored with or the companies. It's amazing when you do it because it's important to you. They say the first law of becoming a successful writer is write a great book, right? And write a great book means that you have to care a lot. If you're doing it for vanity, if you're doing it for branding, those things, it just doesn't work. You find when you care deeply, more people will care. And because it's important to you, there'll be more people like you that's important to. And you know, you can't really chase white space if you don't care more than anybody else. And it's really been amazing to find how many people care about the same journey and how this idea would otherwise seem right out in front of us. It's like kind of obvious, but the greatest ideas typically are. Why didn't anybody do that? When the answer is because it's actually hard and it's a different way of thinking. And so I think I've been really blessed and surprised by the kind of power of the, I like to refer to it as the rip. It gets pulled out of you in how well it's resonated.
I'm really intrigued by your philosophy of co-creating everything that you do. I mean, that's got to be a learned skill in many ways.
Well, also it's physics, right? One horse can pull 22 or 2,300 pounds. Two can pull 28,000.
Oh, when you put it that way.
And, you know, if you get really good at like picking talent and co-founders, you actually get that outcome. So my co-founder, Ann Berkowitz, who's brilliant and amazing, like, we're the opposites. We have deep overlap in the most important things in the company, where we're taking it, the vision, the culture, things we value, how we care about people. But our skills are so different, but so complementary. This company would not exist if she wasn't, you know, an equal part of creating this outcome.
One of the things that fascinated me was one of the books that you also co-wrote was The Intellectual Devotional, which is a look at the seven fields of knowledge: history, literature, philosophy, math and science, religion, visual arts, and music. I've seen the books sitting around and I didn't quite put it together. And I'm just like, wow. I mean, you go from co-writing books about business and entrepreneurship to intellectual devotionals? I mean, how has writing these books changed your career and thinking?
Again, you know, I think that that book, which now is now 10 years ago, really taught me a lesson, which is I'm just going to focus on things I deeply care about. You have to value your ideas, your solution problems, because the secret to that quote unquote success is actually in your proprietary gift and the depth of your care in solving it. So I didn't do that book for commercial reasons. I didn't do that to create a New York Times bestseller, which it was. It's because I just wanted the book. You know, I grew up with spiritual devotionals. Millions of people do. It's existing behavior. And I wanted an intellectual version of that. I wanted to every year restore my knowledge. It turns out millions of people do too. In fact, 10 years later, this last year is one of the number one books in Japan. It's been put into 18 languages. We did five series: health, biographies, American history, it just restored the value that I put on what I care about. And I think that when I talk to entrepreneurs, that's what I'm trying to discover is why you should really value your ideas a lot, because there's probably a lot of people like you in the world. Don't live someone else's company. Don't live someone else's dream. Just build yours.
And when you speak to the phrase proprietary gift with the light of those seven fields of knowledge, I think that understanding of the proprietary gift really creates a much more compelling shape than just like one small subsection that, you know, like, oh, well, maybe it's only business that your gift is in. And yet there's a whole larger canvas, I think, that shapes that proprietary gift in a way.
When I think about proprietary gift, it has very different axes. So one is it's about the problem or need in the world. This has nothing to do with business, just in general, right? What do you most deeply care about in what problem or need? What is your obsessions? And then when you ask, why me? What's my proprietary gift? You're asking, what is the one thing that I have that I can do that I care? It sometimes has nothing to do with skill, it's just obsession. So in doing that, you know, what's that 10X factor that allows me to do that, you know, where every 10 hours feels like one, right? That doesn't really come from an excellent sheep, well-rounded psychology, right? I'm talking about quitting all of your weaknesses so you can literally only do one thing. And we're creating an arc to your life where that's where you end up in that outcome. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens because of where your lenses and your mindset carry you in your time, energy, and your choices.
So with your time, energy, and choices, how have you learned to maximize all those things so that when you make decisions, they're in line with your purpose and what you do?
You know, radical delegation, quitting weaknesses, extreme focus, just building and nurturing and investing in, at a very deep level, a very authentic level, just some of the most talented people I've ever worked with as part of this journey I'm on now. All these outcomes don't exist if not because of the puzzle, right, of skills that you have to assemble and do very well in cohesively bringing people together to actually live out a purpose, live out a mission, where you think of yourself as one of the parts, but equally a part of that outcome. And so that's really what, if I were to look at what have I learned how to do, is kind of develop my own operating system and lead my life that has allowed to value the decisions, value the delegation, value those trade-offs, value the giving away of things and trusting so that I can get the 10X high impact things out of the things that I'm supposed to be doing in every area of my life. And I think that that's a function of your mindset and how you deploy your capital and time and energy.
So what does the future look like for your life and work?
I hope it's a lot like this year. Every year for the last, ever since I had kids, I think, but definitely the last 6 years and starting Bionic has been an incredible journey. Unrecognizable. I mean, every chapter is, it's like being in another era of your life as you grow up, or raising children in a lot of ways. Nostalgia is the enemy. Like, I don't really look back and say, oh, it was better then. It's like, it's great right now. I have a plan for 3 years and we're diligent in getting there. But being here, right here with people, right here in the moment is kind of what we are focused on here. I have this philosophy at Bionic called becoming, which is the reason why it's not under Bionic, it's actually our website's on bionic.com, is that we're here to put people on it and serve them so they can grow, right? Not subordinate them, but to be here so they can figure out who they're becoming. So what I've experienced is whenever you get to the top of anything, some achievement, some outcome, you always realize there's nothing there, right? I made my first million. There's nothing there. I need more. I gained lost weight, gained lost relationships, whatever it is, possessions. It's just never satisfying. So you have to fall in love with the process of who you're becoming, the grind, the valley. That is actually where the joy is at. When you look back and say, why was it amazing? It's because of that grind. That becoming is what we spend a lot of time and energy on here. Because if you're not in love with that process and you're racing to get out of it to get to that top position that you believe you will make you happy, one, you're probably unlikely to get there. And two is by the time you get there, you realize you did it for the wrong reasons and you fell in love with the wrong process. So that's philosophically central to all this, which is I hope my 2020 is as good as 2019 has been because it was hard, because of who we're becoming, because it had difficult moments and had great moments, but they were equally valuable and I loved both of them.
I absolutely love that so much. This idea of just being at peace with where you are at today. That is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Being here, being present in the becoming.
David, this has been an awesome conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I just have one last question for you. What was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
Well, Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, is pretty incredible. That's a good one if you haven't read it.
Is that the one about the psychedelics? Yes.
Yeah, yes. I think that's a really profound book. How to Measure Your Life is an older book, but is a great one to return to every 4 or 5 years. Tools for Titans, Tim Ferriss was great. I love books like that. He's a wonderful guy.
Okay, I lied. One last question. It just popped into my head.
Sure, sure.
If you could co-create with anyone, who would you want to co-create with next?
I think one of the smartest, most creative people that I have not worked with, but I'd love to, because I just love him, is Dick Costolo. Dick was the CEO for many years of Twitter, and he's had a number of companies that have been successful. And he's just a brilliant guy. And he's a good, good person. And he's smart and tough and funny. I love his brain and his person. Yeah, he would be my number one collaborating fantasy.
Well, David, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been awesome to get a peek inside of your mind and how you really approach life and work through the lens of co-creation and becoming. It's just awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I cannot emphasize enough the impact this interview had on my way of thinking, especially the last part about falling in love with the process of who you are becoming. I don't know about you, but for myself, I've really held on to this idea of arrival or getting to some end result, and I always kind of dreaded or even hated the process of the day in and day out work. And so I just feel so much peace and feel that I can take a breath and enjoy the day a little bit more. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.